My name is Danny Wotton. I'm Tyne Team's resident community archaeologist and finds specialist. Now, you might have heard that Tyne Team is coming back. And this autumn, we returned to the field for two new excavations. These brand new episodes are currently in post-production. In fact, actually, I just returned from the lab to look at finds alongside Naomi Supol, our environmental archaeologist. And there will be more news to follow on this in the coming weeks. In the meantime, YouTube gives us a platform to share other stories and interviews from the wider world of archaeology whilst our Tyne Team projects are in development. So please subscribe via the links below to keep up to date with all the latest Tyne Team news. Now, over the years, Tyne Team carried out many memorable digs in people's back gardens, including finding things from Roman mosaics all the way through to Tudor palaces. You may have heard about the amazing story of the young schoolboy Sid, who dug up a 500 million year old fossil in his garden during lockdown. It was a big story here in the UK. So we thought we'd base this interview on paleontology. In fact, way back in series three, Tyne Team actually went looking for mammoths in an Oxfordshire gravel pit with Professor Russell Coop. And we headed to the dinosaur belt of Montana in 2001 for a Tyne Team special to dig up a Tyrannosaurus rex. Now, archaeology and paleontology are two different subjects. Archaeology uses the discovery of material remains to look for clues to understand how people lived in the past. Paleontology uses fossils of plants and animals to discover what life was like millions of years ago before humans. But there are similarities. Both use physical evidence, as I've just said, to piece together and to examine how life, environments, and landscapes have changed over time. And we also share that excitement of excavating things and making new discoveries. So we were intrigued when we heard about the news of Sid's fossil find, and actually even more intrigued when we heard the news over the summer about the discovery of a Jurassic Pompeii, it was being billed as, a discovery in a site in Wiltshire in the UK, which it had been a momentary mudslide that occurred millions of years ago and instantly killed the creatures that were living on the seabed at that moment in time and preserved them for millions of years. Now, the unearthing of this discovery, obviously fossils get found quite often, but the amazing thing about this was that there were new species that hadn't been discovered before, brand new species. So that made this discovery internationally important for paleontology. So I recently caught up with Sid to find out all about his fossil find, and also with Dr. Tim Ewing, who's senior curator at the Natural History Museum in London, to find out all about this Jurassic Pompeii in Wiltshire and more about the world of paleontology in general. And we even looked at when the two worlds of archaeology and paleontology collide. Enjoy. Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks, and looking forward to talking to you guys about paleontology.
Hey, Sid, so tell us about this find that you've made.
I was digging in my garden, just wanted to have a bit of fun because I'm an amateur like digging, well, I did as well, and I still do. And I just wanted to have some fun and see how big my hole would get. Like last time I got up to my knees, this time I got up to where my shin ended, which is kind of just about where my knee was. But I was just digging and I happened to come across this thing. I thought it was a rock or some weird shaped arrow or something like that. But then when we washed it, it looked as if it was something different, something like a horn or a claw or a tooth.
Ooh. So what did you do next?
We washed it and we guessed, and because we went to a place called Lyme Regis, which is a fossil beach, my daddy got this fossil group where he put a picture of the fossil on, and lots of people recommended that it was a horn coral. And then we got the idea that it was a horn coral.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what was it like when you found it then, when you actually discovered it? What went through your mind?
Is it a fossil or is it a rock or is it something special?
And so can you tell us about horn corals then? What is a horn coral?
A horn coral is a type of coral, as it says in its name. And horn coral is just a coral, really. And it lived about 480 million years ago. And
what?
And it used to be like this, in this way, just stuck to the ground, and it would just, and these lines on it would just be floating up, and it would just be, and then it just died off, and then it would become a fossil.
And so is it a plant or is it an animal?
It's an animal? I don't know, really, and I think it's a plant.
I think Tim's nodding here.
It's actually a type of animal, and had little tentacles that sat on top of the horn in life, and they would have caught bits of suspended food particles that were drifting by at the bottom of the sea.
Oh,
so yeah, what you're looking at is the sort of skeleton that it sat on. It's a nice little find.
So Sid, you said how old did you say it was then?
480 million years.
Wow, that's like such a long time ago, isn't it? I mean, is this before or after dinosaurs or the same time?
Before dinosaurs.
Wow. So we've gone back way, way, way back into time here. So where would this horn coral have lived then? I'm guessing in the sea.
Yeah, it is in the sea.
Yeah.
On the coral reefs and, or maybe just hanging on to the cliffs that are in the ocean, maybe that drop off sometimes.
What else have you found then? Have you found any other fossils?
Yes, I have. I've got a couple of samples here as well.
Oh, what have you got there?
Just pieces of horn coral again. There.
And these from your garden?
Yep.
Wow.
This one my dad found, and this one I found a couple of weeks before I stopped digging.
So what is it that made you dig the hole? Were you looking for fossils?
No, I was just actually looking for pottery. Like my mum said, the first hole that I dug, which was where my dad then planted a tree there, my mum said we wouldn't find any fossils in the hole because mummy thought that it's England, and in this part, she didn't know that this part was exactly underwater and that there would have been fossils, and that she thought that I wouldn't exactly dig too deep. But when the house was built, I think when the mud would get higher up than when they were digging, so the house could be made. And I think they moved the mud around a bit, so it was actually quite high up. So I did end up finding it about, I don't know, on the second or third day.
Wow, so you were obviously quite patient, actually, if you were digging for a while, by the sounds of it.
I remember the last time I was digging for more than 2 months.
Oh, wow. You've obviously got the bug for it, haven't you? What is it that interests you about this?
Well, I was first into it when I was about four, I'd say, when I started watching Andy Prehistoric Adventures, which is something on Netflix or YouTube or BBC iPlayer, I think, one of those. I think it's BBC iPlayer. But I got into fossils then. But digging, I was actually quite interested in like animals and like worms, slugs, and things like that. And also pottery. When I first found like glass and pottery, there's loads of different patterns on there.
So, do you have a favourite kind of fossil?
Yes, and that's the T-Rex. A T-Rex.
Oh.
They're very big.
That'd be exciting if you found one of those in your garden, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Whole space of my garden.
Yeah, they're quite big things, aren't they?
Yeah.
So what kind of advice would you give to young people that might be interested in finding out more about fossils?
Usually, if you want to find a fossil, you might want to dig in your garden, but But I'd suggest you go somewhere where people already have discovered fossils, where you are allowed to like explore some fossils, because you're likely to find loads of fossils there more than your garden.
So I'm just going to speak to Tim for a bit. Tim.
Hello.
Hi. This find that Sid's made.
So yeah, listening to Sid's very thorough and brilliant description of how he found his coral, it sounds as though, yeah, he's exactly right, that when they were building the house, they might have sort of dug down into the sort of into the bedrock, and then that's brought up some of these blocks up to the surface, where they've then eroded down into the soil, and the soft mud surrounding the fossil has been eroded away, and just even there's fossils within the soil. And just lying there waiting for someone to dig down and discover them. It's a great story.
So let's just try and put this in a time frame, because we were joking earlier. I'm an archaeologist, you're a paleontologist. And quite often people do confuse the two things, actually. So I quite often get people say, oh, archaeology, I'd love to find a dinosaur. And no, that's not us. That's you guys.
Yeah. It's sort of a real distinction. Although there is that sort of grey area, but we really, as paleontologists, deal with things that are a lot older than when humans started to have a big influence on the environment around them. But there's no hard and fast date, and there's no real sort of other criteria. It's not because something's hard, therefore it's a fossil, or because it's soft, or it's sort of less greatly altered, therefore it's archaeology. And we have a sort of real sort of grey area in our collections, particularly in like the sort of Ice Age mammal collection. You say an Ice Age mammal, like a mammoth, most people think fossil. But if that mammoth has got cut marks that are made by humans, which are sort of defleshing the bones, then that becomes a piece of archaeology and a fossil.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of, there's no sort of hard and fast thing. And, but when it comes down to it, they both have their sort of distinct areas, but there is this little crossover.
Actually, while we're talking about that crossover, actually, I know there's a really interesting hand axe in the Natural History Museum. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So there's a great thing we were discussing earlier about sort of paleontological influences within archaeological contexts. All flints, all these Nat flint tools that our ancestors made. Actual flint is actually derived from the fossil remains of sea creatures like sponges that not a million miles away from the nice fossil that Sid's found. And because of the sharp edges they get, but flint, because it was formed at the bottom of the sea, also has fossilised sea creatures within it. And there's this wonderful hand axe that's actually got a sea urchin fossil embedded in the head of this hand axe. And wow. So the Neolithic human who made them was obviously sort of had an artistic touch. You know, sort of people like to think it must have had some sort of special meaning, but maybe it was just a pretty shape in the stone that caught their eye.
I'm sure it wouldn't have gone unnoticed. Can you imagine, actually, you're sort of napping that away and then you go, whoa, hang on a minute, there's a fossil in here.
Well, I think it's actually more than that, is that they saw it in there, they napped it purposely to get it right in the centre. So it was it was something that was purposely done. And so people recognised that there was sort of special... There was flint, and there was sort of special flint.
Yeah, that would have been regarded, I'm sure, as being very special. Yeah. Wow, fantastic. So we just talked a little bit about that sort of crossover, but let's go back in time now, and like maybe you could set the scene for Sid's horn coral.
Yeah, I mean it was. A long, long time ago. So, I mean, as I understood it, it was sort of Silurian age, so from the Wenlock limestone, about 430 million years ago. And so the dinosaurs really only appeared about 200 million years ago, or 210 million years ago, in the late Triassic period. So this is a sort of almost you know, twice as long ago as the first dinosaurs appeared. So things like Tyrannosaurus rex are actually more closer to us than this horned coral is to dinosaurs, or the earliest dinosaurs. So just to give you a sort of an idea of the length of times we're talking about. So this was a time when life on land was really in its infancy and was only just starting to get going. And when I say that, I mean we're talking like sort of fairly sort of there weren't any trees, there weren't any flowering plants or ferns, or even the only things that were really alive on land were sort of moss-like or organisms and some fairly substantial fungi, almost the size of trees. So it would have been a very sort of strange, almost like Journey to the Center of the Earth from that wonderful film from the 1960s. A very different world. And in the sea, we would have only had sort of primitive fish and sharks swimming around. The oceans would have been dominated by large mollusks. So things that were ancestors of today's Nautilus, but they were about 2 to 3 meters long.
Whoa.
You also would have had giant sea scorpions and Eurypterids, which some of them are 2-3 meters long as well, great big claws and things like that. So quite some interesting stuff, but the atmosphere was quite different today. And Britain at that time was probably sort of was south of the equator, so very different to its position today. Mm-hmm. It was probably in a fairly warm, shallow environment. And there were lots of other things like trilobites and crinoids living in abundance in a sort of reef-like environment. There would have been lots of life around you, but most of it would have been in the sea. So, very few, if any, insects on land. So it would have been a very, different place to what it's like today.
Wow. So, so how old is this horned coral then? You say it's Silurian, did you say?
Yes, that's right. So geological time is divided into lots of different segments of time, and the sort of you tend to sort of swap between things and you hear all these names. Yeah. They do all have definitions, and there's a wonderful International Commission for Stratigraphy if people want to look that up, and that will give you a nice chart and shows you how geological time's subdivided. It's just a convenient way for paleontologists to communicate about sort of general periods of time, and they tend to be characterized by a series or a suite of fossils and sometimes rock types, particularly when those are associated with particular parts of the world. So, we might have heard of, the old red sandstone, which in Britain is always, associated with the Devonian period. But the Devonian period in France is dominated, and Belgium, say, is dominated by deep marine rocks, and so they have a very different concept of the Devonian period to some British paleontologists.
Could you give us a real quick kind of thumbnail snapshot whiz through geological time?
The first fossil life is probably be looking at sort of chemical signatures in the rock, and that really is very old. Talking about sort of 3.7 billion years ago. Wow. And then the next real big milestone for life was at about 1.3 billion years ago, when more complex cells first appeared, the eukaryotic cells, which make up you and I. Next sort of really big event was the Cambrian explosion.
Yes, I love the sound of this.
4.35 million years ago. Well, it sounds really dramatic that there should be a sort of big mushroom cloud somewhere, but really refers to the sudden appearance of life with hard parts, or skeletons. And this is where you sort of, trilobites and our corals and brachiopods and lots of other shellfish really come into it, the echinoderms, which I'm a specialist on. And then you have the next big event was life really sort of diversified And then at the end of the Cambrian, there was an extinction event, and we had the Ordovician, which is characterised by a slightly different suite of organisms.
So we've got the end of the Cambrian, and then we go into the...
The Ordovician.
Okay, yep. And what date is that?
So it's like one of my university exams.
Oh, sorry. That's
500 to about 450 million years old. I can't remember the precise dates. And then at about 450 to about 400, you have the Silurian, which is when our fossil appeared here.
Okay.
And then it's sort of about 50 million, give or take, about 50 million year increments through that. And then you have the Devonian, then the Carboniferous, then the Permian. And all this time, Britain's moving from about 70 degrees south during the Ordovician through to the equator during the Carboniferous, when all the coal was laid down in parts of Britain. Mm-hmm. And then Britain, and it was quite a tropical environment, and then Britain moved up north of the equator during the Permian, deserts everywhere, middle of a massive continent called Pangaea. It was all very, very different. And then at the end of the Permian, we had an event called the Permo-Triassic mass extinction, which is also referred to as the Great Dying, when 95% of species became extinct and things like trilobites disappeared.
Oh, wow.
Lots of sort of mammal-like reptiles, which were starting to really dominate the land by this time, because plants had appeared during the end of the Silurian. It was in great profusion at the end of the Silurian across the world. And then life sort of slowly recovered through the early Triassic. So another extinction event within the Triassic, and then that gave rise to the dinosaurs about 210 million years ago. And then we're up into the Jurassic, and dinosaurs proliferated. Cretaceous, they continued to proliferate. And then we had the Cretaceous Cenozoic mass extinction, or the KT, which has often been referred to in the past. And this is a meteorite impact in Chicxulub in Mexico, in the Yucatan Peninsula, caused a mass extinction event. The poor old dinosaurs, apart from the birds, became extinct. And that, again, reset the clock for the diversification of mammals throughout the Cenozoic. And then humans appeared a mere sort of 2 to 4 million years ago, or the lineage which led up to us appeared about 4 million years ago, although it's one of those how long's a piece of string things. And then sort of modern humans, not really my speciality. Maybe you archaeologists could say about this, but I guess about 400,000 to 500,000 years ago, I think, is when you could sit down next to someone from that time on a bus, and they would be identical to you. And then you've got archaeology and all the wonderful things that people have done.
It's amazing to think, isn't it, just how far back in time you can go, how much life there was on Earth thousands, millions of years, way before humans were in existence. It's kind of...
Yeah, I mean, for me, what it gives is like a much greater appreciation for the world in which we live in.
Yeah.
Not just for the fossils themselves, but also the culmination of life is what we're experiencing now. And why... the life that we see today, the interactions are so complex and often quite sophisticated. And that's because they've had the time to be able to adapt and radiate into all these different niches. And why, as a paleontologist, I find the current sort of loss of modern ecosystems, the destruction of habitats, the change we're doing to our environment, global warming and things like that, is so... catastrophic, because you realize that this stuff takes a long time to appear, and life will prevail, but it won't. The fossil record tells us that it might be drastically different to what we have gone before, and it might take a long time, several million years, not long in terms of the planet, but when it comes to you and I trying to find food, that is quite a sort of drastic and long amount of time to survive. And so it really is a sort of call to me to action and take it seriously.
How do you know? How do paleontologists know what fits into what period? How do you work that out?
There's several different techniques that we can use, but they essentially revolve around dating specific layers, often layers that are formed by volcanoes or igneous vents. So maybe not the sort of lava pouring out the top of a volcano, but you can look at other sort of intrusions of magma, within the rock. And that really, you can look at the decay of radioactive isotopes within those rocks. And you can, and some of those radioactive elements decay very slowly, and therefore you can look at them, and therefore they tell you the age of the rock looking back. Exactly the same techniques as you frequently use in archaeology for things like carbon dating. The techniques are exactly the same. And then you sort of, so you have these sort of igneous rocks, and then everything between those igneous rocks, you know, therefore is no older than the lowest one and no younger than the top one. And so that gives you a relative dating for that package of rock. And then you can look across the world and you can correlate all these things. And that's how we know that dinosaurs existed between about 210, 215 million years ago to 65 million years ago, because we're able to date those rocks. And the reason why those times change subtly is because our measurement of those elements, radioactive elements or decay elements, improves all the time, and so we can refine those error bars, or we actually just you're making a guess at that boundary, because there's no sort of convenient layer with all those isotopes in them, and you might find a new outcrop where you can actually date it, and that gives you a much more precise date. So there's all these sort of different things that go on, and that's the nature of that element of the science. But it does give us a really sort of a surprise. I think people find it surprising how good we can get it. It's just looking for all these little clues, these little pieces of evidence, piecing it all together. And it's a multidisciplinary approach. People are bringing in new ideas, new technology, and so it's an exciting thing, and it's still happening now. It's not something that's dreadful phrase, set in stone, it is set in stone, but not in that sort of sense of the word. And people sort of find that, sort of unsettling sometimes, but in other ways, I think it's great. It shows the sort of, that we don't know everything, that we need people like Sid to, carry on studying and being inspired to find out more, to do better than we've done in the future, because there's so much more out there to know.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, actually, I think that brings us nicely to your most recent discovery. Would you like to? And in fact, actually, Sid was involved with this as well, weren't you?
Yeah. So, do you remember the coming down and visiting the quarry in Wiltshire, Sid?
Yeah.
Did you have fun there? Was it good?
Yeah, a bit too hot.
It was a very hot day. What did you find?
Just a couple of pieces of shells, and I think that was it, and a couple of sea stars.
Yeah, no, you did well. You're finding those sea stars and those crinoids and things. So, we had a very, very exciting invitation from a couple of paleontologists, non-professional paleontologists based in Wiltshire, and they'd made a fantastic discovery of a new site during the first COVID lockdown. And it turned out to be one of the best fossil Jurassic localities in the world for fossil sea urchin starfish and their relatives, and things like called crinoids, which are sort of more commonly known as sea lilies or feather stars. They're very rare because echinoderms are made up of lots of individual plates, a bit like our human bodies are made up of bones that are held together by soft tissue. And so normally when these animals die, they just fall apart into a pile of bones and then they're just dispersed out. And it's very difficult to understand what they look like from these dispersed things. And we rely on these exceptional areas of preservation to really give us an insight into what the world was really like. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we did some filming with Blue Peter, and we got our Blue Peter badges, which I was really excited.
Oh, and, fantastic.
Sid came along and helped us clean up some of the fossils and found some fossils himself, which we've actually added to the museum collections as well, because there's a lot of very nice, very important stuff from that site. I'm purposely not mentioning the name to keep it safe. But the fossils are quite robust. For a little example here, maybe I don't know if you can see that. So this is the crown of a crinoid. So we've got the stem here, the body where the mouth would have been at the top, and then these arms would have been much longer. They would have collected food particles that were drifting past them.
So how significant is was this discovery then, this excavation that you did this summer?
It ranks along the sort of some of the most important Jurassic echinoderm sites in the world.
Wow, in the world?
In the world, yeah. So it's easily the best Jurassic locality in Britain. That's really for the sheer diversity of sea urchins, starfish and crinoids that we're finding at the site. I mean, we've been finding examples of all five representatives of the classes. So including sea cucumbers, which are mostly soft tissue, so to get a fossil of that is remarkable.
Wow.
And also brittle stars as well. And there's loads of other interesting fossils. There's lots of fossil wood at the site. And then looking at the micropaleontology, we've got some really interesting things coming up, as well as, you know, more common shelly fossils and oyster type things. Yeah, we got maybe three or four new species, which is really exciting. And they're all beautifully preserved, sort of three-dimensional, very little crushing going on. And they're wonderfully easy to dig. I imagine it's what it's like to be an archaeologist, that the rock that they're actually preserved in is quite a soft clay. And so it's quite easy to just sort of lift up these sort of slabs of harder limestone and these fossil echinoderms underneath, and just turn them over, give them a gentle clean, they just pop out. We don't clean them too hard. We just do most of that delicate preparation back at the laboratory in the Natural History Museum with a specialist preparator and equipment. But nevertheless, that's what Sid was helping us with, was looking for these fossils, turning stuff over.
In terms of the collections in the Natural History Museum, do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So some of them are super rare. The feather stars that I mentioned before, essentially, they just have these beautiful feather-like arms and these little sort of spindly little legs and a tiny little body for which we call a cup. And in about 200 years of collecting at the Natural History Museum, we've got 25 of these cups of these feather stars. Not even the whole complete one from the Jurassic. And in maybe sort of 5-10 days of collecting at the quarry in Wiltshire, we'd amassed over 3,000 individuals.
Wow.
So it just sort of gives a sort of insight into how good this site is when these things are, you know, for the last 200 years have been super rare. And then at this one site, they're super abundant. And that's really interesting because these feather stars appeared quite late in the fossil record. They only really evolved in the lower Jurassic about 190 million years ago. And we're looking at rock that's about 176 million years ago. So it's sort of quite close to when these animals first appeared and started to diversify. And very early in their history, it's demonstrating that these organisms were able to dominate a seafloor setting. And that's important because they do that today in similar sea marine settings where there's a soft substrate, like a muddy seafloor. And it's really interesting to understand that sort of behavior went all the way back to the middle Jurassic. Mm-hmm. And that's because these mass areas. They call them feather star meadows because they look almost like plants growing up, and they're very densely together. And they sort of create a sort of biodiversity hotspot. So normally the muddy sea floor is fairly barren. And then you get these massive concentrations, and they support lots of other animals because other animals are eating the waste products, their reproductive gametes and things like that. And so they sort of form like this sort of integral chain and ecosystem. So to know that this is something that we're able to extend our knowledge back, maybe 40, 50 million years back into the fossil record, means that what we see today is a sort of as a wonder of biodiversity and a sort of hotspot of individuals. That actually has a very, very long fossil record.
Wow, that's amazing, Sid. How was that? How does that feel to have been on that excavation and been involved in that discovery?
Yeah, I'm just really excited to be there.
Great to have you along.
What did you have to do in terms of, were you digging? How did you find these fossils?
They already did the digging. We just had to search in the piles of rocks and slates just to find fossils on the rocks.
Okay. So do you think you might want to study this in future, or do you want to do something completely different? What do you think you might like to do in the future?
I don't know, just find fossils maybe.
Brilliant stuff. Well, both of you, it's been really fascinating. We should also give a shout out to your parents, Sid, because I understand they're Time Team fans. So, hello. And oh, here he is. Hey, Vish.
Hi.
You must be proud of Sid.
Very much so, yes. He's been so excited ever since we went, he found that fossil, and we've been invited, really lucky to have been invited to so many places to learn more about fossils and meet some really great people like Dr. Ewan from the Natural History Museum.
Chris, who's another paleontologist.
Another paleontologist at the Jurassic Coast, wasn't it?
Was it the Jurassic Coast or was it a different beach?
Jurassic Coast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from the Jurassic Coast organisation.
He found an ammonite and a piece of coprolite. And the ammonite was black, and I think I've still got it in my room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we've been really lucky that we've been able to take Sid to these places because of what he found and expand his mind. And also, especially in our neighbourhood as well, nobody really knew, or even we didn't know, what sort of landscape we lived on. Mm. So it's been great to learn more about the landscape that we live on and the area that surrounds us as well. It's been a fascinating journey for all of us.
Yeah.
And Time Team, yes, huge, huge fans growing up watching Time Team. Yeah, we couldn't believe it stopped. And we couldn't believe it was on for 20 years. It felt like a blink of an eye.
Yeah, it's a long run, but the really cool thing is that it is coming back. We filmed two programmes recently back in September that are due out soon, so that's going to be really exciting. And we've got the Patreon channel as well, so people can subscribe and help support us to bring back Time Team. And we've got the YouTube channel as well. So, it's been an exciting journey for us as archaeologists, actually. So do watch this space, because we've got some really interesting stuff coming up. And just before we go, actually, maybe we could just get a little bit of information about, what do people do if they find a fossil? What's the best thing to do? Where can they take it?
They can either take it to the museum, or if they think it's a good fossil, then they can, or if it's a big fossil, then they can. But if it maybe, or they can be like me, or go on the news, or if they don't want to go on the news, maybe go on Time Team or the News Round or whatever.
It's absolutely right. The first protocol would be your local museum. Or the Natural History Museum runs a fossil and rock identification service. So if you just look on our website for Identify Nature, you can follow the links through to the sort of right spot for fossils. We also all sorts about the British biodiversity as well. And there are other sort of collectors forums out there on Facebook and in the on the web as well. So there's plenty of resources out there. And if it's important, they, you know, people were normally fairly generous with their knowledge, and they'll sort of tell you, the relevant places to go. So the great thing about paleontology is that amateurs and non-professionals can make just as telling contributions to the science of paleontology. So, you know, it's great that people can go out there, as long as they're looking safely and responsibly. So, you know, if you're on private land, you need to get the permission of the landowner and things like that. And don't take risks, you know, climbing up sea cliffs to ridiculous heights just to try and see if there's a fossil up there. The best fossils are normally on the beach.
So, Tim, I believe actually there's a recording scheme in the Jurassic Coast for people to record fossils.
Yeah, that's correct. Not every fossil needs to be recorded, but they've got a list of special particular types of fossils that they want recorded. You can get access to that recording scheme through the website at the Jurassic Coast World Heritage Site.
Fantastic. Brilliant stuff. Well, it's been fantastic catching up with you all. Sid and Vish, thank you so much for joining us. Tim, thank you. Good
pleasure,
luck.
Thank you.
Good luck, all of you, actually, with your future endeavours, and particularly with this fascinating excavation in Wiltshire. Look forward to finding out more about it in the future. And Sid, best of luck with fossil hunting.
thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Bye. I'll speak to you all soon.
Bye.
Bye.
To ensure you catch all the latest updates, please do subscribe to this channel, follow us on social media, sign up to our newsletter, and join us on Patreon.